Okay, it's time to start now. So can I have quiet, please? So once again, I apologize for the situation with lecture notes today. I'm expecting a delivery of more lecture notes at some point near the start of the lecture, but I'm just going to ask Kirsten to leave them at the back. And so those of you who don't have lecture notes, please collect the lecture note on your way out of the lecture today. And I'm sorry it makes it impossible for you to take notes on the lecture note themselves, but I'm afraid that can't be helped. So today, as you probably know, is the last lecture with examinable content on the course. There is then no lecture on Friday this week. You've in any case got the, I think you've got the, right. Hi, Kirsten, can you just leave them in two piles at the back, and then people can collect them on the way out if they haven't got lectures, if they haven't got the notes. So I think this afternoon you've got the object-oriented programming mock exams during the afternoon, so there's no lecture on Friday. There's one more lecture on this course, which is next Tuesday, and that's going to be a lecture about examinable material and to give you some pointers about what format the exam is likely to be. Okay, so today we're going to look further at the statistical analysis of data, so we're going to do more on the topic of analyzing data, and we're going to look at one more test for correlation. So last time on Tuesday's lecture, we looked at what's called the correlation coefficient, which is a way of discovering if we've got, and also measuring, the correlation between numerical data. So you've got two variables of numerical data, and it works both for interval data and ratio data, if you remember the data scales we had two lectures ago. And so it enables you to say in a positive correlation, if one variable increases, then the other correlated variable also tends to increase at the same time. But sometimes you want to get correlations, to look at correlations between categorical data rather than numerical data. So today we're going to look at a method that enables us to do that, to discover if two categorical variables are correlated, that is, if there's some relationship between them. And I actually misled you in Tuesday's lecture. I said that I apologized for the examples being rather introspective. So we'd looked at the course questionnaire two lectures ago. Last lecture we looked at the actual data for coursework versus exam results from last year's data and analysis course. Today's lecture, I'm afraid the first example is going to be similarly introspective. We're again going to use the same data for last year's data and analysis course, but we're going to look now at a different kind of correlation between two categorical values. And so we've got on the one hand the question, did a student submit the coursework? That's categorical in the data scale, because the answer is either, there are only two possible values, they either submitted the coursework or they didn't submit the coursework. We're going to see whether there's a correlation between submitting the coursework and obtaining on the exam an A grade. So as you may know, in the university grading scale, A is given to any mark greater than or equal to 70% that's obtained in an exam. So that's a very good mark. If you get greater than 70% on the coursework that you submitted last week, then that will be judged a very good mark on the coursework. So how do we look to see if there's a correlation between these two? These are categorical data scales, because also getting an A grade is something you either get or you don't grade, or you don't get. So there's just two possible values. You either get the A grade or you don't get the A grade. So once again, we're going to apply the general approach we have to a statistical test. So we need a null hypothesis, which is again that the data is not correlated. And the test that we're going to apply, which is called the chi-squared test, so it's labeled using this Greek letter chi, allows us to again compute the probability p that we might get data, the result of the test that we've got were the null hypothesis true. And once again, we look for a small value of p, because a small value of p means it would be very unlikely were there no correlation between the data that we would get the result of the test that we've got, that we would get the data we've got. And then that would allow us to reject the null hypothesis and conclude that there is most likely a correlation. So to begin with, and this is the important first bit, how we compute the chi-squared test is we construct what's called a contingency table. And to do that, we've basically got four different possibilities. A student either submitted the coursework or didn't submit a coursework, and they either got an A. We're only looking at students that both submitted the coursework and took the exam, because it only makes sense to apply this test to those people. And they either obtained an A in the exam or they didn't obtain an A in the exam. So we've got four possible tables, and we'll put in the number of students, the frequency as it's called in each case, the number of students that are in the relevant categories. So here we've got those numbers. So if you look at the data, which is now online, that I presented in Friday's lecture, then we see that of the students that submitted, 42 got an A, that submitted the coursework, 42 got an A in the exam, and 49 didn't get an A in the exam. And of those that didn't submit, 7 got an A in the exam, that didn't submit coursework, 7 got an A in the exam, and 19 didn't get an A in the exam. So for students that submitted the coursework, a little bit less than half, there are 91 students in total that submitted the coursework. 91. Yeah, 91 students that submitted the coursework, a little bit less than half of them got an A and a little bit less than half of them got an A and a little bit more than half of them didn't get an A. And of those that didn't submit the coursework, very slightly more than a third of them got an A and slightly less than two-thirds of them didn't get an A. So from that data, who would guess that there's a correlation? Who would guess that there isn't a correlation? Don't be shy. Who would make no guess at all? Well, that's the safe thing to do, because statistics is a difficult thing. You don't know. It's very hard to say just from looking at the data, and this is one of the reasons we need to apply statistical tests, so we can say with rigor what the answer is. When I looked at this data, I thought, well, that looks like a correlation to me, a reasonably strong one, because here, if you submitted the coursework, you got almost a 50% chance of more or less of getting an A, and if you didn't submit the coursework, you've got pretty much a 35% chance of getting an A. So anyway, we shall see. And how do we work this out? Well, we need to perform the chi-squared test. And the next slides are about how to calculate the chi-squared test. The basic idea is we've got our contingency table of the actual data, and we're going to use that to construct another table of the expected data that we would expect to see were the null hypothesis true. Then the chi-squared test compares the two. So the expected table is the data we would expect to see if there were no correlation. We compare the two, and if there's a large discrepancy between the two tables, then we can conclude the chi-squared test allows us to reject the null hypothesis and conclude that with significance there is a correlation. So the means for calculating it are explained in a number of slides, and you basically calculate what are called marginals, and then you use the marginals to calculate the expected values, and then from that you calculate the chi-squared test. And the reason I'm not going over this is it's very dry to explain these formulas in a lecture, and rather than doing that, I'd like to look at the data itself, see how the form, and then after the lecture you can go back, and for the tutorials this week you will be calculating chi-squared results, so you'll get familiar with the formula there. But I want I think it's better in the lecture to get an idea of how it's working by looking at the data itself. So in the lecture, we're going to do that. So here we have the original contingency table. And what we've done at the bottom and the right is we've calculated what are called the marginals, which are simply adding up the columns and the rows. And it's easy to understand what these mean, because here this is the 91. We've added up the two entries for the students that submitted the coursework. So these are the 91 students that submitted the coursework. These are the 26 students that didn't submit the coursework. And overall, we add up the frequencies for those that get an A. We've got 49 students that get an A and 68 students that didn't get an A. And in total, there are 117 students. And of course, you can get that by adding either these two numbers or these two numbers, you get the same thing. So if you add up either way, you get the same idea. Now, you get the same total. Now, the expected frequencies say, well, if the data were independent, how many students would there be in each category in order to get these proportions of student of total proportions of students that get an A against a not A, and this, the same proportion here of students that submit and don't submit the coursework. And you can calculate that because, so what we want for the expected number of students that submitted the coursework and got an A, well, if we want the proportion, if it's the expected number where the proportion is again 49 to 68 here and 91 to 26 here, well, we simply multiply the 49 times the 91 and divide by 117. And so the expected number would be 38.11. And then we do the same thing for each entry. So here we multiply 26 by 49 and divide by 117. Again, that's the same expected number to keep the same proportions. And we do the same here and here. But there's an easier way of doing it, because in this resulting table, the rows and columns add up to the same marginals. So instead, once you've calculated this number, you can simply subtract 38.11 from 91 and get 52.89, and subtract 38.11 from 49 and you get 10.89, and so on. So you can fill it in like that just by using addition. You only need to do the multiplication once. And now we've got the expected frequencies, we're going to calculate a measure of the difference between these two tables. And if this difference is large, that implies that, well, that's suggestive of a correlation, because this table represents the frequencies we would expect to see if there were no relationship. So if there's a large difference from that, then that's suggestive of a correlation. And the actual way you compute it is you compute the difference between the entries in the tables, square it. So I'll go back. So here's the formula here. We're squaring the difference between the entries in the respective entries in the two tables, and divide each one by the expected frequency. So the first entry will be 42 minus 38.11, which is 3.89, squared, divided by the expected frequency for that place, which is 38.11, and then we make a sum for all four things. And actually, when you've got a 2x2 chi-squared test, the numbers that you square are all the same. That's an interesting mathematical fact that you can work out for yourself why it's true. So we've got 3.89 squared divided by each of the expected frequencies, and we add them all up. So that's 15.13 divided by each of the expected frequencies, add them up, and then we get this sum here, and that comes to 3.09. So the chi-squared is 3.09. That's the measure of difference between these two tables. Well, what does that mean? Well, again, we look this up, just like the statistical test we were looking at yesterday, we look it up in a critical values table, and we get our probability value. And we see here, so our value is 3.09. We see here that that's greater than this critical value, 2.7, but not greater than this critical value. So that means we have a significance for this test of 0.1. So were the null hypothesis true, there's a 0.1 chance that we might get this kind of value for our chi-squared test. That's a 1 in 10 chance, were the null hypothesis true, which is a small chance, but not really a significantly small chance. So from that, those of you who suggested there's no correlation, well, it's not that there's no correlation. There is, in a sense, some evidence of a correlation, but it's weak evidence. It's not really significant, because the probability threshold, the probability value, is just 0.01. So we're able to say there's some evidence of a correlation between submitting coursework, but the significance is a low significance. That's p at less than 0.1. And since a standard significance threshold for a statistical test is 0.05 rather than 0.1, you normally look for at least a 1 in 20 significance, a 1 20th significance. This would not be considered significant data. So, in a sense, the data is indicative of a correlation, but not significantly so in this case. So, this year, almost everybody did the coursework. So, in any case, you don't really need to worry about whether you did the coursework or not. And in any case, the most important thing in first year courses is to pass. Getting an A turns into a more important task in the third and fourth years of an undergraduate degree at Edinburgh University. But in any case, so this data, this analysis here shows some evidence, but not very significant, of looking for of a correlation between the getting an A and submitting the coursework. Okay, so that's the main technical content of the lecture. I want to do one more example a little bit later, but I thought for today's the illustrative example part of the lecture, to give you an example that's quite unrelated to what we've been doing, except that it concerns, there's a crucial role being played by the notion of statistical significance at the end, that you'll have seen that been referred, there's been, this example's been referred to a lot in the media recently because it's a current hot topic, and you'll see where statistical significance is important. So this example, let's take this projector off. So this example concerns a situation in which we're analyzing data in the real world, and we're trying to actually learn something very fundamental, and this is to do with learning the correctness. Well, actually, you can never learn the correctness of a physical theory, the theories of physics, but one's trying to get evidence of at least showing that physical theories correspond, do give an explanation for reality. And so I'm going to, in order to get to the point about significance, which is going to be the last thing I make, I need to give you just a little background in fundamental physics for those who don't know it, but not at a technical level, but as probably many of you know, there are, as far as we know, according to theoretical physics, there are four main forces of nature. There's the electromagnetic force, the weak force, which is a force between subatomic particles inside the nucleus, another strong atomic force, which is also between subatomic particles inside a nucleus, and there's gravity, which is, of course, a force that works at huge, at a range of huge distances, but is in fact the weakest of the fundamental forces. And physicists have been trying for a long time, I mean, for a long time they didn't know about the weak and strong forces because they only knew about that once they were able to look inside nuclei, but for a long time they've been trying to unify these various forces, and the currently accepted theory of the electromagnetic force was developed in the late 40s, early 50s, and that's something called quantum electrodynamics, QED, and this was developed by Schwinger, Feynman, and a Japanese called Tamaga. And then, quite a bit later, in the late 60s and early 70s, they incorporated the weak theory with this, and this became what was called electroweak theory, because it incorporated both electromagnetic and weak forces, and this was developed by Abdus Salam and Steven Weinberg. Although, when they published their papers in 1968, nobody was interested in them at all for another 3 years, until two Dutch people, Veltman and Tuft, sorry, can I have quiet, please? showed that this theory satisfies a very fundamental property called renormalization, which allows you to calculate with it. And as soon as this was done in 1971, suddenly this theory took off and everyone realized, actually, although it had been around for 4 years and or 3 or 4 years and no one had looked at it really, this was the explanation for the unification of these forces that actually worked. Anyway, and then in the mid-70s, then the strong forces were incorporated in something called quantum chromodynamics, and that was done by, the main force there was Murray Gell-Mann, and there are other people too. I think that's how you spell it. This is the theory that includes the famous quark. So in any case, and this is kind of the situation we're in now, because nobody knows still how to incorporate gravity in this picture. But this, taken together, this whole theory has been wrapped up in what's called the standard model of particle physics. It's been tested and very successfully. It basically explains all subatomic interactions that we know and a lot of macroscopic behavior too. And everybody I've mentioned on this board got the Nobel Prize for their contributions to this theory. Although one should also mention perhaps there's somebody called Freeman Dyson who made an equally strong contribution to this theory here, who wasn't awarded the Nobel Prize because the Nobel Committee are only allowed to award a prize to 3 people for any single contribution. So, unfortunately, this Freeman Dyson was overlooked in the Nobel Prize, and that's going to be important later because, as probably many of you know, there is one important ingredient of the standard model that was introduced in 1964, which is the Higgs boson. I'll just call it the Higgs particle. A boson is just one of 2 kinds of particles. There are bosons and fermions, depending on their spin properties. So the Higgs particle, introduced in 1964 by Peter Higgs and 5 others in 3 different papers. This particle is the only particle in the standard model that has not yet been properly observed in experiment. And of course, as probably most of you know, there's currently a very big experiment to try to find the Higgs particle at the CERN Large Hadron Collider. But there's also another one that's just finished in the USA, which is called the Tevatron. This one has seen tantalizing hints of the Higgs particle, as has this, but people are still investigating to see exactly whether, to be able to say whether or not we can conclude that the Higgs particle exists. It's the one missing ingredient of this standard model. Now, Higgs and the 5 others have not yet been awarded a Nobel Prize because the Nobel Prize for physics has to be for experimentally confirmed physics. And theirs is the one bit of the standard model that has not yet been experimentally confirmed. People are expecting the Large Hadron Collider to get enough data this year to be able to confirm the existence of the Higgs particle. And that's then going to present the Nobel Prize Committee with another dilemma. It's only allowed to award the prize to 3 people for 1 piece of work. And there are 6 people here that have that proposed this theory. So anyway, it remains to be seen what will happen there. Of course, they need to discover the Higgs particle first. Now, I want to say that the reason this is related to what's in the lecture is I want to talk about what constitutes a discovery of the Higgs particle. But before we do that, let's just have a look at Peter Higgs, which, for those of you who go to lectures at James Clerk Maxwell building. You'll be familiar with him because there's a big portrait of him in the stairwell in James Clerk Maxwell building, because he is an emeritus professor here. He was professor at Edinburgh University for something like, well, at the time he proposed the Higgs particle. So anyway, for decades he was a professor here. This picture was actually taken in the informatics forum across the road in 2-3 years ago. And anyway, so Peter Higgs is now over 80 years old, and hopefully, well, he is hoping, I guess, that in his lifetime the Higgs particle is going to be discovered, and with luck he might even be given the Nobel Prize for it. So the point to connect this with what we're doing in the course is to talk about what constitutes a discovery for a particle. So so essentially what they're doing at the Large Hadron Collider, they're bombarding lots of subatomic particles together at very high energies, and they look to see their interactions which they view through the decays of the particles, and they collect data from that. And when they get their data together, they'll get a value. Let's put a value of, which let's suppose they can wrap that up as a real number, and this would be the real number zero. They managed to code up all their data as a value, and the null hypothesis would be in this case that there is no Higgs particle. And were the null hypothesis true, well, there are certain chances of seeing certain kinds of data as their results. And actually, that's in a kind of normal distribution. And actually, I'm going to make it sort of quite low and flat because, well, then it gets very close to zero there. But it's actually greater than zero here. It's just very, very close to zero. And also going in this direction. And so it's not a very good bell-shaped curve, but anyway, here we've got the standard deviation going to the point of inflection where it changes from concave to convex. Okay? So who knows what will constitute a discovery of a Higgs particle? What's the accepted? Does anyone know? Sorry? Somebody's... Pardon?
5 seconds.
Yes, who's saying that? Yeah. 5 seconds. And do you know what that means? So this is the standard deviation. And basically, the probability of the value landing in this region is quite high. And as you go out, it gets much, much smaller, as represented by the lowness of this. And this is sigma here. And 5 sigma is way out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Of course, my drawing's not very accurate. And here we've got -5 sigma. And to have a 5 sigma degree of certainty, 5 sigma significance, means that the values, the value of the experiment, or all the experiments together, needs to lie outside this 5 sigma, -5 sigma to 5 sigma range. So in here or in here. Which looks like a very, very small probability indeed. And we can see what the probability is by looking at the Wikipedia page. Wikipedia is very useful for many things. And then, well, here there's a better picture which goes to 2 sigma and 3 sigma. And they don't go as far as 5 sigma because you're getting down to such small data that you can't really see it. But down lower in the page, there's a table. Whoops, where are we? Here we are. And we see, and again, I can't use the laser pointer when I'm using Explorer, but here we see the 5 sigma. I don't know if you can see it there. It's sort of somewhere about just below halfway down. And the 5 sigma, the chance of getting 5 sigma data if there were no Higgs boson, if the null hypothesis were true, is 1 over 1,744,000 278. So that's, so this is what is accepted as a discovery in physics. So they're very, very demanding in order to say that, you have really discovered a particle. And at the moment, the results from the Fermi lab and the CERN lab are both at the 2 and a bit sigma level, which means about 1 in 20 chance that you would get that data if the null hypothesis, if there were no Higgs particle. But taken together, that makes about 1 in 400. But still a long way short of this level of certainty required. So this is an idea. So even our physical theories, our understanding of our physical theories, is based on this notion of statistical significance that we're using in the course in order to assess the significance of our statistical tests. But in that case, in the case of physical theories, the statistical significance is really a very, very high significance that they need. Very, very demanding, very small probability. Okay, so there's one more example to go through in the lecture. Okay, there are some subtle points about the chi-squared test, but I think there's no need to really talk about those. They're not, actually what I wanted to do was that. No, not that, this. Yeah. So those aren't examinable. This actually relates to something in the tutorial that we consider that actually the chi-squared test is considered unreliable when you've got a very small number of data, for example, 40, and or one of the four expected values is very small, for example, less than 5 is normally taken as the threshold. That example we had there is reliable because the values are greater than 5 and the value of n is greater than 40. Okay, so the second example was something we touched upon in the corpora part of the course, which was the notion of a collocation. You remember that a collocation is a phrase, it's an n-gram, and we're just looking at bigrams here, two-word phrases, that occurs atypically often in language usage. So we can use a statistical test to test whether a two-word phrase is a corpus. And to do that, and I'm not going to go through the calculations in detail, I'm going to really just rush through this a little bit because you've already seen one calculation done in detail, so I'm just going to talk about the reason one's doing it this way. So to do that, one constructs, again, a contingency table where you use a corpus. This is the Dickens corpus here that's being used. We're looking to see if strong desire is a collocation. So we look at all the bigrams in which you've got strong desire, all those bigrams in which you've got strong but not desire, but a word other than desire as the second word, all the bigrams in which the first word's not strong but the second word's desire, and the bigrams in which neither word is strong nor desire, of which there are very, very many, 3 million plus, 3,400,000. And so, again, we can calculate the expected values table, but now this isn't a reliable chi-squared test anymore because this value is now much less than 5. It's very, very unlikely that one would get the bigram strong desire with these values for the relative proportion of the occurrences of the different kinds of bigrams. But nevertheless, if one goes ahead with a chi-squared test, one gets this huge measure of the discrepancy, and you can see that that's very, very statistically significant. So there is a correlation between strong and desire in this corpus with probability, let's say the significance is a very good significance of a thousandth. But all that tells us is that with very, very strong significance, There is a correlation between the word strong, occurrences of the word strong and occurrences of the word desire. And because language is non-random, basically if you take any two words that can occur together in language, you would expect there to be a correlation. Because if you say one word, the number of words that can occur next to it are restricted by just grammatical rules. So this is actually a meaningless result, in a sense. There is a correlation, but there could not be a correlation. So there has to be a correlation anyway. But nonetheless, what you can do is you can look at other bigrams in the corpus and rank them according to the chi-squared values, and then those with very high chi-squared values represent those that occur atypically often. So doing that, one can get a measure of how atypically often a bigram occurs, and one can conclude from that when a bigram looks as if it is a collocation. So it's a bit of a forced example. It is of interest to linguists. Actually, they tend to use a different test for this called the T-squared test. That's not part of the course. But anyway, one can use chi-squared called the T-test. One can use chi-squared to do this. But what I want to end with is something I think more interesting, which is an example of chi-squared where it was of legal significance to see whether there was a correlation or not. And this is what's called Berkeley University in California in America, a sex bias case. So this was something that happened in 1973 that some applicants to Berkeley University tried to sue Berkeley University because they said Berkeley University was discriminating against female applicants for its places. And this is this contingency table is just for a fragment of that survey, but there's I'm going to put on the blog a pointer to the paper that has the full survey in it and the discussion of it. But then this is the analysis that was done, part of the analysis that was done related to that case. So here we've got a contingency table. We've got the male applicants here for university places, the female applicants, and the number accepted and rejected in both cases. And we see here that the success rate of male applicants is 53%, and the success rate of female applicants is 46%, and the chi-squared for that is 11.66, which if we look back on our which is even the 0.001, so very high significance there. If there were no correlation between gender and accepting the student or not, then we would only have a 1 in 1,000th chance of getting that data. So very strong significance for that correlation. So from that data, hands up if you think that the legal test should succeed against Berkeley, the legal case should succeed against Berkeley University. Okay, nobody. Hands up if you think it shouldn't succeed. Does somebody want to say why you say it wouldn't? Did you know this or no? But so the various reasons that maybe it shouldn't succeed. One is a moral reason that you think, well, that this might not tell the whole picture. But on the face of it, it looks as if there is clearly a correlation between the sex of an applicant and their likelihood of getting accepted for a university place at Berkeley University. So anyway, what happened was the defense team in this case looked at the data in more detail, and they uncovered some very interesting phenomenon here, which is explained on the next slide, which is that you can divide this data into two blocks. This is the students applying to science faculty and the students applying to arts faculty. And actually, the science faculty has a much higher acceptance rate in general. So So the general acceptance rate is 64% of applicants to science faculty places are accepted. Whereas the arts faculty has quite a low acceptance rate, only 40% of applicants to the arts faculty are accepted. But a much higher proportion of the applicants of the arts faculty are female than for the science faculty. Well, the science faculty, there's a ratio of 8-1 male to female applicants, whereas the arts faculty, it's actually 2-4 in the other direction. So it turned out the female applicants, more of them were applying to the arts faculty where there was a much lower chance of being accepted. So in fact, the discrepancy between the male and female success rate is actually rather explained by the more female applicants were applying to the arts faculty, and there was a much lower chance of getting in at the arts faculty. And if you look at the data for each individual faculty itself, you actually get a surprising reversal that in the science faculty, the success rate for male applicants was 62% and for female applicants was 80%. And in the arts faculty, success rate for male applicants is 35% and for female applicants is 42%. So actually both faculties were preferring female students, but taken together, a female student was less likely to get in than a male student because she was more likely to apply to the arts faculty that was much tougher to get into. So anyway, the case failed against Berkeley University, but it was very interesting. And this paradox, this is called Simpson's paradox, nothing to do with me. This is another Simpson from about a century ago, an American, who noticed this strange thing that actually you can have bias, and in both cases, significant correlation in favor of it. So in both cases, there is significant favoring of the female applicants in two different subpopulations that, when added together in a single population, gives a correlation in the opposite direction. It's very counterintuitive, but this data gives one example of how it can happen. And really the lesson here is to distinguish a point that I made in the last lecture, distinguish between the existence of a correlation, which certainly occurs in this case. There is a correlation between being male or female and between being successful or not as an applicant. And to distinguish between that and the causality, what's causing that discrepancy. So what's causing it here is not the sex of the applicant, but rather the tendency of male and female applicants at this time in the 1970s to apply to either a very competitive faculty, the arts faculty, or a less competitive faculty, the science faculty. So this is, again, the moral of this is that one has to be very careful in statistical analysis to learn the right lessons from the data, because the lessons are not always the ones that, if you take the data at obvious face value, you need to sometimes probe more deeply. Okay, so, well, that's it for the examinable material of the course. As I said, there's a revision lecture next Tuesday. Are there any questions before we finish today? Yes? There are no lectures after spring break. After spring break is a revision period. The exams are, I believe, on the 8th of May, but I'll say more about the exam in the next lecture. Okay, so see you next Tuesday.